You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 3rd to the 9th of November 2016. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan and writers Matthew Rice and David Matthews. Post-Brexit, could the UK see its leading research talent leave? John Morgan has been looking into the risk of a UK brain drain if its scholars can no longer access EU funding programmes. More on that shortly. At many universities in not only the UK, but also the US, Canada, Australia, have in the last 20 years or so been setting up international campuses. It doesn't always, however, go to plan. Matthew Rice will have more on how institutions should perhaps go about international expansion if they want to be rather more successful. And in China, the Gaokao, a punishing university entrance exam, is often held up as an example of meritocracy at work, since only the best performers are granted a coveted university place. But is the notion of winning a university place on merit alone a myth? David will tell us more later. And across Europe, in the US and of course in the UK, there has been an increasing appetite for populist parties and their policies, as the Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton election battle finally nears completion. What does this new world mean for universities? John Morgan's cover feature looks at that very issue this week, and we'll hear more soon. But first, it is to you, John, actually, on a story that sits in our news pages. A lot of rhetoric about this, a lot of conversations about post-Brexit. What will happen to the UK's research talent? Will they up sticks and leave, particularly if they can't get hold of the funding that they used to get hold of? That's what you've been looking into.
That's right. I've spoken to a number of senior figures in the UK and universities across Europe, and there's a consensus that Brexit may present some real challenges for the UK universities in holding on to their research talent, but that in turn could bring benefits for rival institutions across Europe and Germany, the Netherlands, Republic of Ireland, seen as among the potential beneficiaries who might be able to tempt away top UK research talent.
And that's UK-based research talent, of course, because there's many Germans, Italians, Irish, US, Chinese, to name the top five sort of citizens based in the UK doing that.
You are indeed correct to pick me up on that point, Chris. Thank you. UK-based research talent, because importantly, we're talking about not just UK researchers, but all those who have come from outside the UK to work in the UK at British universities and who may kind of be more inclined and more mobile to leave if the UK's circumstances do change. So what this all boils down to is the fact that there's still no certainty as to whether the UK will remain inside the European Union's research programmes post-Brexit by securing associated country status for research. And if the UK were to be outside those EU research programmes, wouldn't be able to take part in the international research collaborations on societal challenges currently under the Horizon 2020 badge, or take part in the EU's prestigious European Research Council grants for outstanding individual researchers and people like Gaiman, Novoselov, who born in Russia and came to the UK. They're people who benefited from ERC grants and gone on to win a Nobel Prize in the UK at Manchester University, so that shows the importance of those. And I spoke to a former president of the ERC, Helga Novotny, who said that UK nationals might look elsewhere, especially Germany, and also warned that she didn't think the UK would be able to stay in the ERC because she believed it would be tied to the principle of free movement in labour of labour if the UK did want to stay in that. And obviously the free movement of people is a big bone of contention for the UK. But one of the examples I looked at is Ireland, and already they've got in their budget, they had mention of funding to start a new initiative to attract world leading researchers in the context of Brexit. So I spoke to a number of people in Ireland who were talking about the benefits that it could bring to Ireland if they were able to bring across people from the UK post-Brexit, particularly those who want to stay in the ERC.
I recall seeing an advert in the THU's pages, in fact, for recruiting academics from the UK.
It's very interesting that Ireland is, you know, openly trying to poach researchers from the UK. I think in your piece, Germany, you think, or rather someone's quoted as saying, there aren't any plans for Germany to lure researchers across. But I wonder whether, if negotiations become rather more fraught over the next 2 years, whether, you know, you could have sustained efforts by lots of EU countries to poach lots of UK-based researchers. It could be sort of open season.
I guess
Ireland's already doing it.
Yeah, the director of the German Academic Exchange Services London office was kind of keen to play down any prospects of poaching, but both he and the representative of the Association of Universities in the Netherlands both said that, yeah, while they wouldn't have sort of national strategies to do that, it could certainly happen at individual university level, whereby you might have something more active perhaps happening there in terms of trying to attract UK-based researchers. And yeah, as I say, it may all come down to the issue of free movement and whether you know that it is possible for the UK to remain inside the EU's research programmes without the government signing up to free movement of people, and come down to the question of whether the EU does try and make that political link with the free movement issue.
Indeed. Well, you can read that analysis on page 6 and 7 in the magazine, and of course on timeshighereducation.com. I'd also recommend you check out a previous feature by John Morgan on Switzerland. You went out there and asked a few questions. They're very relevant to this discussion, as I'm sure you can imagine. Now, writing in his leader this week, John Gill, the editor, says, with Brexit looming, to keep it on that issue, one of the interesting questions for universities in the UK is whether they will shift their gaze to continental Europe when planning their next foray overseas. And this relates to a feature, Matthew, that we've got this week, looking at the sort of international campuses that universities have set up down the years and how they might be tools for success for universities, even though they aren't always necessarily turning out that way.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I wrote a piece about Mauritius a while ago. There have been several British universities with satellite campuses there, and some seem to be doing very well and some have been closed. So it's clearly clearly there is great potential in these areas, and also great potential for getting one's fingers burnt. Mm. And this is a piece by Kevin Dunseith and Chris Hall at Isis Enterprise, which are part of Oxford University Innovation, and it's actually looking more generally at the issues of internationalisation for universities and what it means and how you need to think it through. There are all sorts, and they say they're not only talking about full-scale satellite campuses. I mean, they're also talking about things like extensive online provision. And they say that, there's in not much of the developing world, there's reason to believe that parents and students don't think that that's kind of proper education. Mm. And therefore it's hard, even though it might seem to be a very good way of, dipping one's toe into the international market without sort of investing in buildings and so on, there are all sorts of problems. I mean, they talk about, basically they're saying you just have to think it through very carefully, think through what your market is, think through realistically about when you're going to get a return on your investment, making sure that there is genuine enthusiasm from, the senior people within universities, so that these whatever satellite arrangements are made are not kind of just out on a limb. And one of the concrete things it says is, whenever you have your travel budget for these things, you should always raise it rather than lower it, on the principle that if you get both the senior management coming out to have a look at what's being done, and also people in the whatever satellite institution you have coming back to head office fairly regularly, this is really quite important to making sure that these projects are actually taken seriously.
Absolutely. Well, page 40 and page 41 this week, I indeed John Gill's leader as well, which is on page 5 and in the opinion, in the opinion section on the website too. David, over to you now. In China, the Gaokao is a fairly punishing university entrance exam. You went to university for a while in China. I doubt you had to sit the Gaokao to do your particular course.
Unfortunately not.
But you're a man with some experience of the of the system. But this piece you've written is all about whether this sort of notion of winning a university place on merit alone is possible, or whether it's a myth.
Yeah. So as you say, the Gaokao, it's basically the university entrance exam in China, and it is extremely punishing. Students work very, very hard, and lots of pressure from their parents very often. But the other thing about it is that it's supposed to be very meritocratic. You know, there's not nearly the influence as there is in the UK of things like personal statements and interviews at Oxbridge and that kind of thing. The idea is generally you get a Gaokao score, and with that Gaokao score you sort of try and get into your first or second choice university or third choice, whatever, a particular tier of universities. So it's supposed to be a sort of national system where, you know, even the humblest rural family, if their child does well at the Gaokao, they can get into Peking University in Beijing. But this meritocratic idea has been attacked in a new book by Ye Liu, who's a lecturer at King's College London. And she's really attacking this idea of meritocracy in university entrance in China. And the first thing she points out is there's huge regional disparities in China. So, if you live in Beijing, for example, you've got a much better chance of getting into places like Peking or so on, because they allocate so many more places to local students. Mm. So these kind of really high-end universities that lead to decent jobs and so on are concentrated on the wealthy eastern coast.
And conversely, if you're in a rural area or a cold spot, as I've heard them refer to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are some sort of dispensations for very remote provinces like Tibet and so on. They do sort of, you know, some of her evidence shows that, you know, there's a sort of a Chinese version of affirmative action in some provinces like that. But in other poor but not completely remote provinces, it's harder to get in than if you live in Beijing or Shanghai or somewhere. Mm. And the sort of second strand of her argument is she, you know, befriended and interviewed lots of Chinese students as they made their way into universities. And they're from poor families, but once they get to university, their kind of total belief in this meritocratic system is gradually destroyed, because they don't have a laptop because they're really poor, whereas all of their much richer course mates do. So they have to, you know, queue for the computer centre and that kind of thing. Mm. And they don't have the contacts to get internships and stuff. And so there's, I mean, it's perhaps more extreme, but it's sounding a bit like the UK, where the idea of meritocracy has been under attack and also used by politicians. It's sort of some, you know, Theresa May, new Prime Minister, will see it as a good thing, in that wherever you come from, whatever your background, you have an equal shot at success. Whereas, for example, the sociologist Michael Young, who, you know, died about 15 years ago, always thought of meritocracy as a dystopia. It's a sort of, it kind of justifies the winners in society in believing that they really deserve all this wealth and success, because they believe they're, you know, they are there on merit rather than simply having the good fortune to be born in particular. So it's a global, it's a global thing for policymakers and politicians to grapple with, you know. Meritocracy has still a lot of currency in both Britain and China, but I think what this shows is that it's under attack in China as perhaps never before, as inequality grows.
And a smaller story this week by you as well, David. You mentioned that the overseas students are allegedly being given an easy ride on this meritocratic Chinese system.
Yeah, this is really, this is a piece in the kind of quite nationalist Global Times party-linked newspaper, where it's saying ethnically Chinese students whose parents have immigrated, say, Canada or Australia or wherever, and got foreign citizenship, are then able to avoid the Gaokao by applying as international students to places like Peking, and they have to take, you know, what is allegedly a much easier route in. Mm. So this is how sensitive the Gaokao is, and how important people think it should, you know, the fairness of the Gaokao is such a huge issue in China, but it may not be what it seems.
Indeed, we'll read about it on timeshighereducation.com and in the magazine, of course. And then finally, I should start this section with an apology, really, because our front cover features a quite hideous image, in my humble opinion, of Donald Trump's face spliced with Nigel Farage's face. John, why have we put that on the front cover?
Perhaps your reaction betrays the attitudes of liberal elites, Chris, to the rise of populism.
Never.
So what we're looking at in this week's feature is the rise of populism and what it means for universities. Universities are institutions that could be acutely affected by the rise of populism. And looked at a recent paper by a couple of political scientists in the US who've looked at the rise of populism. We can see a tripling in the share of seats in national and European elections gained by populist parties since the 1960s. We know that the Swiss People's Party, Austrian Freedom Party, Front National in France and Freedom Party in the Netherlands, all increasingly popular, and we can see in the success of UKIP in being the catalyst for the Brexit vote and in the rise of Trump, that this is a global phenomenon. And what this paper tells us about populism is it defines it as resentment of existing authorities, including intellectual elites and scientific experts. And they say that this paper says that populism favours closed borders over the free flow of people's ideas, labour and capital, and traditionalism over progressive and liberal social values. So I think we can understand populism as being a particular threat to universities.
At loggerheads in many ways with what they would...
Those are fundamentally at odds with the values of universities as liberal, internationalist, cosmopolitan institutions, and the rise of populism might threaten universities not just in jeopardising the free flow of researchers and students and consequently the free flow of ideas, which universities thrive on, but also in the sort of the breakdown of support for UKIP and support for Brexit and for Trump. One of the key distinguishing factors there is whether people have a university level education. That is a key determining factor on which way they go on those issues, with people who haven't been to university much more likely to support Trump and to have voted for Brexit. And also another aspect is the key role that anti-expert rhetoric plays in the language that populist parties deploy. I spoke to a professor called Ruth Wodak, who is now working at the University of Vienna on construction of Austrian identity, and she points out that it's a key defining characteristic of populists that they define themselves as speaking for the people, and the people just instinctively know, and it's the voice of the people is defined against that of experts. And consequently, that's why populist parties tend to favour referenda, because you can authentically access the voice of the people there. So there's a number of ways in which it challenges universities, but I've also looked at the ways that universities can the views of some people on how universities can try and depolarize the politics around this and reach out to general populations rather than allowing themselves to get boxed into this portrayal of being part of a liberal elite, which could threaten universities' funding and their ability to communicate with societies if they allow themselves to be defined in this way by populists.
It's a really fascinating issue. I always wonder whether, particularly in the US, whether universities can act in this sort of bridging role in a way, when there are lots of surveys that show, you know, particularly sort of social sciences, humanities, academics are so heavily Democrat rather than Republican. I just don't really see it as plausible. I think we had a piece a few weeks ago. It was a ratio of 11-1 Democrats to Republicans among social scientists, and something like 30-1 amongst historians. And yeah, you know, I think you'd expect some liberal bias, I think, in universities. I think, given the sort of anti-expert nature of this, but this, it seems so tilted. I don't know how certainly social scientists can really be seen as sort of honest brokers if they try and reach out and bridge this divide.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge, and it's kind of disconnect between the political profile of academics and the general population that's accelerated much in recent years and probably reflects the polarisation of American politics in general. And I've spoken to a couple of people who have ideas on how to counteract that, but as you say, it's a massive problem.
Indeed. Well, you can read that fascinating feature in this week's THE, and of course under the features section at timeshighereducation.com. That's all we've got time for this week's THE issue review podcast. If you wish to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything you've read on our site, then you can do so underneath the articles themselves. You'll also find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn. But that's all for this week's THE issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.